From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, why a cybersecurity expert believes it's not a company's IT department that should be preparing for the next hack.
Later, why one research firm says Milwaukee is on the list of up-and-coming places to live in the United States.
There's opportunity here, and there's people that are definitely interested in living in the city. And I think that's, like you mentioned, with the new hotels and new developments for luxury units, that there's proof there that the city is on the rise once again.
Plus, a conversation with poet Aja Monet.
And photographer Margaret Musa talks about the medium in which she works, a process called tintype.
It documented all the Civil War and part of the Wild West. And it is the wet plate process that came before film was even invented.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Institutions in the United States were generally spared the worst of the recent ransomware attack called WannaCry. But that's no guarantee that the U.S. won't bear the brunt of the next cyber attack that comes along. Analysts are still assessing the damage from WannaCry and looking for vulnerabilities that exist in its wake.
But experts say that's not the only response companies and other organizations should take. Jen Rathburn is a partner with the Milwaukee law firm Foley & Lardner and specializes in cybersecurity issues. She's with us in the studio to offer some perspective on WannaCry and what's next. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
For someone in this field, what was and maybe what wasn't surprising from the WannaCry attacks as you saw them?
Well, they were not surprising at all. I mean, we've been forewarned about ransomware attacks for years and that they're on the increase. I think actually what is kind of funny is that I actually co-founded the Midwest Cybersecurity Alliance, and we held a meeting last Thursday specifically on ransomware and business email compromise. And leading up to it, I was like, well, ransomware is old news. You know, are you sure you want to focus on it? And then WannaCry came. So, I mean, we're just seeing a large increase in cyber attacks in general. But it was not surprising.
Well, and so if it was old news, I mean, this is something that's been on the radar of people in your field for a long time. How come it came as such a surprise seemingly to so many other people, do you think?
I think the issue is cybersecurity is a very complicated area. It's very difficult to predict where the attacks are coming from. It's difficult to understand your risks. I mean, I think in the past, this was something that was outsourced to IT personnel for companies and said, you know, build us a fortress, build us a big wall, prevent all these attacks. We know now that we're not going to be able to prevent everything and that really we have to, you know, prepare more to respond for attacks. And so your question is good. We knew ransomware was coming. Why don't you prepare? I mean, some of it is money. Some of it is, you know, in this particular instance, is many of the companies that were affected did not patch, you know, in
right.
enough time. And so the question is, should you be patching and what is the average of doing that? I mean, and I think it varies from company to company. On the legal side, which I approach things, you know, not just from a, you know, technical, but I also really focus on the legal side is that, you know, are companies going to be liable in the event they didn't do this patching? And I think that's what the industry is talking about is what are reasonable security measures? What should you have done? In this instance, I think, you know, because it was Microsoft, that patch was available, people should have been patching. Whereas some people wait to patch because they have to see, you know, how it's going to affect their networks or applications or other systems. Here, I think people should have been doing that.
Right. I was surprised. I guess it was just Tuesday, we learned that something like two-thirds of the companies in the computers that were affected by this latest attack were still running Windows 7 without the latest security patches, which seems kind of unfathomable for an organization. As you say, with some in some instances, there are questions about, you know, whether a patch is going to be effective. But what would keep somebody from installing a patch on something as basic as an operating system like Windows 7?
I mean, I really can't say, you know, because I'm not an IT person, but I've asked that same question myself. I mean, I think it really just depends on the particular company and how many people they have to staff all of this. I mean, you have to understand companies are getting attacked from so many different ends on a daily basis, and they have to figure out how best to use their resources. I mean, I would say with ransomware is in addition to the patching, I mean, people really need to think about how they're backing up their data. Are they doing that offline? I mean, how can they respond in the event of a ransomware attack? Because maybe it's a patch today, maybe it's something else tomorrow, and it's more thinking about how do you maintain the availability and integrity of your data? So I think it's not just about the patching, it's thinking holistically about how your data is maintained and what happens if you do have a catastrophic event, whether that's ransomware, whether that's some other sort of disaster, or just a regular everyday malware attack from a cyber attacker.
And a few minutes ago, you just said, you know, this used to be just about the IT professionals in a company. If not just the IT professionals, who within a company or a large organization ought to be involved in this kind of planning?
I love that question. Actually, in fact, what it's moving more to is risk management and is really trying to figure out what are my particular risks at my company. Each company is different. I mean, some companies have healthcare data. Some companies have financial data. Some companies are high on IP. It's really trying to figure out what are your crown jewels you want to protect at your company and figuring out what kind of risk are we going to accept? What are we going to mitigate? What are we going to outsource? What are we going to insure for? So I think the question people now are thinking more is, really, what kind of risk does that data or an attack bring to our company? And that has to be pushed up to the board of directors, where the board or the C-suite really has an understanding of where that risk is. It's not about technical. You can't be overwhelmed by technical details when it comes to cyber attacks. It's more about where is our risk and how are we going to manage that from a risk management perspective.
Which is not to say that the IT professionals shouldn't be working to ensure that some certain level of security does exist.
Oh, for sure. I mean, but that's almost the minimum because that's always going to be there. You're always going to have IT security controls in place, but they're going to change. And as we've seen, the attackers, unfortunately, are ahead of the game. And so you have to really think more about what happens if we get attacked. And also not just for yourself, but what vendors are you using? You know, every time you bring a vendor in, that brings risk into your systems. And if they don't have good security policies and procedures and controls, that brings risk to you as a company.
You mentioned, you know, all the various kinds of crown jewels that are at stake here, whether it's healthcare data or something else. How specifically are the ransomware attackers looking when they attack? Or are they just, you know, sending these attacks out willy-nilly and, you know, it happens that they've, you know, they've hit a company with healthcare data or some other kind of vital data?
Excellent question. I mean, their purpose really is not to steal data with ransomware. It's really to shut you down. I mean, essentially what happens is, you know, on your computer screen, this ominous, you know, face or whatever, different verity comes up. And then there's actually call centers where they have people waiting for you to pay your bitcoins in ransomware. It's really about shutting down a company so they can't operate more than really taking or stealing data. Usually the data is encrypted so the company can't access it. That's why I was saying with having backup data, you know, if your data is all backed up, then you're really not at the whim of the attacker. But you have to think, are we going to pay this ransomware? Are we prepared to do it? And many companies do. I mean, the FBI recommends not to pay. And obviously, you don't want to pay, you know, somebody that's trying to extort you. But in certain instances, you may have to do it if your data is not backed up. So it's a question you want to think about and perhaps practice in advance. If we are going to have a ransomware attack, do we know how our data is backed up? How do our systems interconnect with one another? Are we going to log? Are we going to shut down? Are we going to pull plugs? What are we going to do if we have that attack?
Well, and these are the kinds of questions that presumably clients are asking you.
They do ask me those questions. And what's interesting, too, is ransomware. I mean, the biggest question is, do you have to report a ransomware attack? And it really depends on the factors. It depends on the ransomware type, what type of malware it is.
And you say report. Report to who?
Well, you could have to report to state authorities, to potentially your consumers. I mean, in the healthcare space, there's actually been FAQs issued that the government presumes that if you have a ransomware attack that is presumed to be a breach that's reportable. But there are certain things where you can do a risk assessment, and that's based on – I work with lots of outside IT forensic investigators that come in and do a forensic analysis. They prepare a report, and then I review it from a legal perspective to try to figure out, does this trigger state or other federal data breach reporting requirements.
It sounds like to look at the ransomware or the ransomers' motives, if you will, it's almost like they're coming in and they're stealing a safe and they don't really care what's inside the safe. They just care that you pay to get the safe back.
Yes, very true. Very true. They want to just interrupt business operations.
Well, and so maybe this is the most obvious question in the world, but would you imagine we have seen the last of the WannaCry attack? Is this specific ransomware going to mutate, if you will, and show its head again?
They always mutate. I mean, everyone has been talking about, oh, the second round is coming. And, I mean, there's definitely a round of ransomware that's going to be coming, whether that is based specifically on WannaCry or not. I mean, a lot of people have theories they were just testing this out, and now they're building more data and evidence about how it works. I mean, I can't say for sure. I mean, I don't want to be a scaremonger. I mean, the reality of it is I'm even more of a scaremonger. So what about WannaCry? There's going to be lots of other types of ransomware or other malware attacks that are coming. And companies that think that it will not happen to them, it's just simply not true. So my best advice is really try to figure out how to prepare and respond. Develop an incident response team. We've seen from the statistics and the data, developing an incident response plan saves you the most money. So I don't mean to be a scaremonger, but something is going to happen to your company one way or other. I mean, this is the new age. I mean, people do not fight people or come in and steal things on foot very much anymore. It's all through technology, and companies need to be prepared or their secrets will be stolen, whether that's to, you know, a hacker in their basement or a nation state. Companies have to begin to become prepared. And I think most companies are now realizing the risk and at least doing something to move that way.
Is there a takeaway for somebody who doesn't run a company who might just be concerned about their own data?
Yes, there's many takeaways. I mean, from an individual perspective, I think you really need to monitor your accounts because, you know, credit cards are stolen or, you know, companies have credit card breaches all the time. And so I really think that the best thing to do is monitor your accounts. And if you see suspicious activity, then you really need to go. The FTC has really good guidance about identity theft for individual consumers. And obviously, if you get a letter in the mail that your information has been breached, take it, you know, take advantage of that free credit monitoring at a minimum.
All right. Jen Rathburn, thank you so much for your perspective on all of this.
Thank you.
Jen Rathburn is a partner with the law firm of Foley and Lardner in Milwaukee, and she's one of the leaders of the Midwest Cybersecurity Alliance.
Why Milwaukee is making the grade as one of the country's up-and-coming places to live when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It's hard not to see the many changes currently happening in the city of Milwaukee. From the torn-up streets making way for the new Milwaukee streetcar to the ongoing construction of the new Bucks Arena, the city is making a visible transformation, unlike anything we've seen in recent decades.
And it's not just Milwaukeeans who are taking notice. U.S. News & World Report just ranked Milwaukee as one of the top three up-and-coming places to live in the country.
Sam Radbill is a content manager at Abodo, a Madison-based startup which analyzes housing market data. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about how the city's housing market stacks up to others in the U.S. and Milwaukee's status as an up-and-coming place to live.
There is a lot of new development, more than in previous years and decades in the city. There's a lot of luxury apartments and new arena for the Bucks going up. And a lot of the educational institutions are growing and building out and developing. And there's just more opportunity in the city now than we've seen in the past. And whether that's in housing, more developments and more available apartments, whether that's, like I said, sports and that coming to the city in a new arena that is really, you know, revitalizing downtown, and also headquartered businesses. You know, there's Northwestern Mutual with a new building, Manpower Group, Harley Davidson, obviously. There's a lot of Fortune 500 companies that call Milwaukee home, and that provides a lot of opportunity for students and professors and people just living in the city.
As you mentioned, there's a lot of development going up. And I think all of us who live in Milwaukee, we're seeing all of these buildings go up. We're seeing new hotels, new apartment buildings. Are there people coming into the city from your analysis and from what you know in your work? Are there people coming into the city to fill those spaces?
Yeah, we found from our research that, first of all, developers aren't going to start projects without the idea or proof of concept that there are going to be people coming into the city. For example, you know, the U.S. rental market saw historically low levels during mortgage finance boom. Those are steadily shifting back to norms, and that's impacted new apartment starts. And we, our research has shown that people are moving to Milwaukee, whether it's coming from Chicago or Minneapolis, or you know, to work at some of those big companies or just to start up businesses. There's opportunity here, and there's people that are definitely interested in living in the city. And I think that's, like you mentioned, with the new hotels and new developments for luxury units, that there's proof there that the city is on the rise once again.
So you just have this analysis of the housing market in Milwaukee. Before we get too much into the numbers, what are the numbers actually based on?
So the numbers in our report are based on the U.S. Census Bureau's 2015 American Community one-year survey estimates. And that's about occupied housing units in the Milwaukee City, you know, Milwaukee, Waukesha, West Allis, metropolitan statistical area. And we also have rent rates that comes from Oboto's proprietary data, which we track each month and produce rent reports based on one-bedroom apartment rates throughout the country.
So the number of renters in the city of Milwaukee has substantially increased, as have rents. What do those numbers look like? What do those numbers really look like in Milwaukee? And how does that compare to other cities in the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So compared to other cities in the U.S., Milwaukee has quite a few more renters. You know, from in 2012, for example, you know, there were about 58% renters in the city of Milwaukee. That number is almost towards 60 as of 2015 and on the rise in the last 2 years as well. As far as home ownership is concerned, that rate is falling. And this is something we've seen throughout the country, and that's pretty on par with the rest of the nation. In 2011, there were 42.8% of owner-occupied units in Milwaukee, and that's down, as of 2015, to 40.5%. So you see a slight decrease there and an uptick in renters, as I mentioned.
With home ownership, it seems like mortgages have also gone down. Is that similar to the rest of the country?
Yes, that is. So we've seen, you know, as rent rates increase and people are kind of moving toward a renter by choice attitude. You know, maybe that's a lot of millennials who don't want to be stuck in a certain city because they own an apartment, or it could be baby boomers who are looking to downsize and head toward the city. We are seeing that the demand for apartments is causing a little decrease in mortgage rates. For example, in Milwaukee in 2011, the average owner-occupied rate was $1,399, and 2015 was $1,257. So once again, you see a bit of decline there. And also, you know, to that same point, you see, you know, an increase in rent price with that demand.
So Milwaukee's story is often one of segregation. I feel like almost every story we talk about involves segregation to some extent. But this is something your analysis actually gets into.
That's correct. So we obviously, you know, as a former, I grew up in Milwaukee and lived there for first 18 years of my life. And it's true. You notice that there is a bit of segregation, and more than most, obviously, number of reports will show Milwaukee as the number one most segregated city in the country. And we saw the similar factors and similar statistics shown in our report. You know, white people owned about 59.3% and rented for about 34.2%. Black or African American people in Milwaukee, about 25% of the time they own property, and almost 46% of the time they were renting. So this shows a huge kind of disparity between who's renting, who's owning. And that kind of goes along the lines of, like you said, you hear a lot of reports and studies and locals will tell you that the segregation is a real thing. And it's proven here in the study as well.
One of the most surprising things I found was the number of renters who are below the poverty line. That seemed unusual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we analyze a lot of, reports and our own data about, you know, who is cost burdened, who is, you know, in poverty. And what we saw was the majority of people across the country who are renting are you could say they're cost burdened, which would mean in real estate and in apartment renting, they spend more than 30% of their income on rent. When it comes to poverty in Milwaukee, it's 39.1% are below the poverty line. And, you know, it just goes to show that there's going to be very much difficulty trying to purchase a home if you are, you know, struggling to pay your rent or you are, you know, below the poverty line. So nationally, 24.4% of renters are below this line. And in Milwaukee, like I said, it's 39.1%. So that shows a huge, huge difference there as well, which is obviously not great.
When considering these levels of poverty in the city of Milwaukee, does that impact our status as an up-and-coming city? I don't think we necessarily view up-and-coming cities as having these rather big systemic issues of, you know, both segregation and poverty.
Sure. I think, you know, it's interesting. There's a lot more poverty in every city, you know, whether it's New York or San Francisco or Milwaukee or, you know, Madison. There's, you know, millions, 40 million, over 40 million people in poverty in the United States, and they have to live somewhere. And obviously, it doesn't look great if, you know, a city has a high poverty level. But that's something that's, you know, going to happen in every city across the country. And I don't, you know, we don't think that it should reflect entirely poorly on the city as an up and coming kind of, you know, in demand city. Obviously you wish there was less poverty in Milwaukee or in Madison or Chicago. But there are still a number of amazing things happening in the city, which we think are still going to draw people to that area.
Sam Radbill is a content manager and senior communications manager at Ubodo, a Madison-based startup company that lists apartments and analyzes housing market data. For more information, you can head to WUWM.com.
Poet Aja Monet will read her work in Milwaukee later this week. We'll speak with her next on Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. It's hard to encapsulate a person's life and experiences in printed words. No matter how eloquent the writing, there'll always be moments and pieces left to speculation. This was one of Aja Monet's biggest worries when she first thought about publishing her poetry.
Although the poet's career goes back more than 15 years, her new book, My Mother Was a Freedom Fighter, is her first published collection. The poems provide a glimpse into Monet's experiences as a Caribbean-American woman growing up in Brooklyn and traveling the world, and they reveal the moments of contemplation that make up the fabric of who she is today.
Monet spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers by phone and began by reflecting on her career as a poet and how she came to creating this collection.
I have been reciting and writing and facilitating poetry workshops and working with poetry in the New York City poetry community for some time since I was a teenager. And I came up with a youth organization in New York City called Urban Word NYC. And I went off to college. I went up to grad school. I traveled to Europe. And I've been performing since I can remember. But I had never really put together a full collection of poetry. And I think for a variety of reasons, but some of the larger reasons had to do with just accessibility and like timing and really in some ways even fear of just putting together a collection that would somehow reflect only parts of myself and not like the full scope of my work, because I've done so many things and I've been a part of so many different projects over the years. So what came to making this happen was as I, you know, became more involved and the movement for Black Lives became more of prominent in the everyday contemporary conversation and public conversation, I realized that the issues and the things that I had been talking about for years that sometimes left me isolated from certain communities or sometimes made me feel as if I wasn't fully appreciated or valued, because I did a lot of conversations around politics and gender violence and justice and things of that nature. And I think that that was maybe part of the reason why I didn't feel very welcomed or supported in making a collection But once I found a larger community and that these conversations have been happening, I think I felt like I could put a collection together and that it would be received at the very least.
As you mentioned before, for a long time you were really just performing your poems. What is it like seeing them written down in this collection versus how you live them in a way?
That's a good question. I think I feel accomplished to do it because for so long I had said, oh, one day I'm going to do it, you know. And there were not a lot, but there were specific people in my life who were really like, you need to do this. And maybe that's why I even stood away from doing it more. I think now that it's actually a real thing and it's tangible and it's in my hands, it's still kind of surreal because, one, to have something that I could pull out of my bag and say, oh, all the poems I'm going to read tonight are from here. Like, I'm usually the poet that comes with like 4, 5, 6, sometimes 7 journals and like random scraps of paper to read. So it's like every time it's an experience on stage for me to just find the poems that I want. And basic, you know, simplicity, it's just nice having a lot of poems in a collection where you could just open them to a page and get to recite what you want. But then the other thing is sometimes it's really hard for me because, you know, what people see on the page is not always what reflects what I'm feeling in the moment. So poems, I feel like, are a process. They're not really a product. They're not meant to be digested and then taken as definitive thing. I feel like they're always changing as you're growing and developing. It's just a definitive, you know, so finite, like having something in print. And sometimes poems change for me, you know, based on a mood or where I'm at in reciting the poem. I'll repeat words over and over based on the rhythm or the inflection that I feel is necessary for that moment. And you can't always translate that into the written word. There's positives to publishing, and there's also just the things that you can't always translate.
So this collection, My Mother Was a Freedom Fighter, the poems come from really different parts of your life and your experience. What connects these poems? What makes them a collection?
Well, I think part of it is I'm the connector. and what connects them is, I'll coin the term or use the term that Kimberly Crenshaw really elevates, which is intersectionality. And I think that as I became more aware and I started to read more, I realized that my poems weren't these separate, isolated things that I only experienced. But I started to make connections to society and systemic violence against Black and brown bodies, but specifically women. And when I realized that, you know, these violences that were taking place in society were really so interconnected, I was like, wait, hold up. This is all stems from a deep violence towards women. And we have so much judgment of women, how they perceive themselves, how they portray themselves, how they move in the world. But we don't have any critical analysis about what has shaped the women to see themselves and move in the world the way that they do. And then also, how do I reflect on the things that I've experienced so that I can heal and move forward and make, you know, radical and transformative decisions that will elevate myself to a new place, that will take me out of, quote unquote, the suffering and bring about a revelation of some sort that can make me an active participant and agent of change in the world. For me, these poems are about trying to find freedom for myself and trying to understand what freedom is to me so that I can actively grow and heal and be a better person in the world. You know, I can't really tell other people what they should be doing if I'm not working on myself to try to do it. And that's a daily process. Some of these poems have gotten me through some really tough times. They continue to. And so they're connected by my own experiences in the world, but they're also connected by the violence in the world against women and women's struggle to respond to that violence and to heal from that violence. These poems have in some way been the way that I've tried to change.
There's this interesting stylized way that some of the poems were written, specifically language frontiers, but it's something that appears in others as well. The words are kind of scattered into different groupings, but they still have this linear meaning. In a lot of ways, it does feel like you're listening to someone say these words, but how do you describe that style, and what is it add to your work?
in that specific poem, I think what I was really working to do was to play with language in that way where you do sometimes feel a multitude of voices when you're reciting it, or even when you're reading, that I believe, you know, we're constantly in conversation with past lives or other selves. And that poem particularly came out of a really crazy experience I had, which might sound a little kooky, but I teach at this place called Omega Institute. It's a center for holistic studies. And I had like this really deep reflection when I went out into the woods one day and I was just meditating. And as weird as it sounds, I could hear and feel other voices while I was writing. And not in the sense like, there's this voice telling me to do this, or there's this voice, but I knew in my own voice and hearing myself recite the words that there was something else also speaking with, and maybe not just through, but with me. And so it felt like less about something talking to me or et cetera, but it was more about that we carry voices with us, whether we realize it or not. I don't ever come to the page alone. I come with my ancestors. I come with, you know, other folks who walk with me in my blood, who have been through these journeys. And somehow we assume that, you know, when people pass or that they're not physically here, that they're gone. And I think that culturally and just, you know, my upbringing, we knew that spirits were always among us and that we were never, you know, truly, quote unquote, alone. And so that seemed to be, you know, in this poem seems to be a kind of a, you know, reclaiming of that. Especially, you know, having gone back to Cuba and some of the experiences I had when I was there, you know, growing up in America, and you don't really talk about, it's not something that's like in modern everyday conversation in schools, et cetera. You don't learn about those things. You know, I learned to have pride in this history of, you know, ancestral lineage and conversations that dealt with and went deeper into our spiritual being and the process that is not something separate from us now. It's never been separate from us. And so writing is not just about really, you know, how cool something looks on a page, but it's also about how do you become a vessel, you know, and how do you really actively listen to one's self, one's history, and what that means for who one will become or how one will see the world. It's part of that listening. It's part of that intuitive, I don't know, I guess calling. But that poem was me working through that and trying to understand, oh, this thing that seems like spoken word or slam poetry, whatever people call that, you know, that seems like this separate genre of poetry. Like, no, that's what poetry always was. You know, poetry was birthed in the voice. You know, it spawned from observation of the world, of course, and intuitive listening. But it is born on the tongue. And I think that that's something that poem is trying to talk about.
Something you mentioned inside of that, this idea that there are a lot of voices that come to the page, that our history informs how we view the world and how we live inside of it, seems to be something that comes up in almost every poem in My Mother Was a Freedom Fighter. Now, when I first read that title, like I guess I assumed that the poetry was possibly about the civil rights movement, that it would be specifically about your mother. But in fact, you have a poem by the same name, My Mother Was a Freedom Fighter. Why did you choose that as a title?
Well, because I was meditating on my own mother and how we talk about freedom fighting. And it's really weird. Language is a funny thing, especially English language. It's more anguish than it is a liberating thing sometimes, dealing with the English language. But, you know, freedom fighter could work like freedom fighter, fighting for freedom, or, you know, fighting freedom. There's a play on words there that is actually really interesting that I've started to reflect on. But what I've learned is that women who live and move in the world, particularly mothers, like just the world doesn't really seem to cater to mothers. It doesn't really seem to care about mothers, doesn't really seem to actively make room for life to be easier for mothers. And it's really interesting when mothers are the ones who give life and who create the actual workforce that we all benefit out of. You know, if you think about it in strictly numbers, you know, economically, because it's like one thing to romanticize a mother's duty and be like, oh, you know, mothers are the birthers of the world and really make that sound really sweet. But the practical reality is that mothers actually create the very foundation of how society and systems and people function. So if we are not celebrating and honoring the women that bring and have the ability to bring life force, then what does that say about our society? And also, how do we create more room to really reflect on this ability that women have? You know, that for better or worse, yes, we're challenging how gender looks in society today in a way that has never been seen, you know, or talked about. But there's a reality that mothers predate, you know, gender, in my belief. You know, they have the capacity to hold both masculine and feminine energy in their body. And so that's why particularly women have never been in the efforts of, you know, delegating who someone is or isn't. They just honor that life is a life and a life is a life and it deserves to be nurtured and it deserves to be taken care of. But what society has done has made it very difficult for mothers to do that. And so I think that poem is really just looking at some of the horrors of these women who have moved in the world and historically who have tried to nurture and tend to the lives of the world. And if, you know, if we can start to look at that, then maybe we can start to really build a foundation for the society we claim to want, for what we claim freedom to be.
Well, Aja, thank you so much for joining me here on Lake Effect, and thank you so much for sharing your work.
Oh, thank you. I mean, thank you for caring to talk about my poem and for making time to have this conversation. I appreciate it.
Aja Monet is a Brooklyn-based poet. She joined Lake Effect producer Joy Powers by phone to talk about her first collection of poems called My Mother Was a Freedom Fighter.
Monet will be in Milwaukee this Saturday for an event at Boswell Books at 7 o'clock. There's more information on the collection and the event at WUWM.com.
The Pfister Hotel's artist in residence is a photographer, but she's not shooting digitally or even on film. We'll learn about the 150-year-old technique she does use when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Since 2009, Milwaukee's Pfister Hotel has sponsored a unique artist's residency program. For 12 months, the artist selected sets up shop in a space off the lobby by the elevators on the first floor and practices their art in full view of the public. The artists have been painters, sculptors, fabric artists, and this year, it's a photographer.
But don't look for a DSLR or even a Polaroid point and shoot. Margaret Muzo works with glass plates and an early photographic technique that predates film called tintype. I visited her Pfister studio one recent morning, and she began by describing how she set up her studio space.
It is a dark green walled room that almost looks like a living room and less like an art gallery or an art studio. I think I did that because I kind of have a problem with white walls and I don't really know why that's a thing for art galleries and art spaces. Especially for me, if this is going to be a place that I create, I want to be comfortable here.
So the Pfister allows you to change the wall colors and kind of make, you can't make, you know, physical changes like taking out walls, but you can change your colors.
That's correct. And I also, I have a dark room here too that was easy to make with the closet that was already in here. I just switched the light bulbs and put red ones in.
So tell me what it is you do. I know tintypes are involved. And so maybe for those of us who don't exactly know what that is, we might have heard the word, but we don't know what it means. Explain that if you would.
Sure. Tintype was a method that was very common in the 1800s. It documented all of the Civil War and part of the Wild West. It had a lifespan from like the 1860s to the 1870s. And it is the wet plate process that came before film was even invented. So it starts with a liquid emulsion that I poured directly onto a piece of tin or a piece of glass. And through a series of chemical steps, it becomes light sensitive. And I load it into the back of a large format view camera where I expose it from anywhere between 1 second if I have all my lights, or if we're outside, maybe 6 or 10 seconds. and I develop it right away. So it's a little different than film too, because it's not as though I could take the tintype and develop it the next day or a week later. I have actually about 10 minutes when I have to develop it. It's called the wet plate process because the whole thing, development and all, has to happen while the first element of chemistry is wet. So anywhere I go with my camera, anywhere I want to take a photo, I have to be within walking distance of a dark room of sorts and all of my chemistry.
So that means if you're outside doing this, you have to really bring an entire kit with you. You have to bring an entire dark room and all of the materials with you.
That's right. I have that in my trunk. I kind of turn my trunk into a dark room for times like that.
Do you crawl in and actually develop in there?
I just stand against the trunk and have curtains that wrap behind me, blackout cloth that wraps up behind me.
So how did you get involved and interested in this particular thing? Like you said, it only had about a 10-year span before like glass plates and other things were invented that kind of took the photographic process forward. So why are you interested in this older process?
That's a good question. It did have a very short life because it is a very fussy chemical process, and it is not easy. But, you know, when I started this, I was ready for a challenge in my life, I think, and so it sounded really hard, but also it sounded like the results were really worth it. And I was always interested in history and old things, and that meant old photographs, and so I was always curious about why an old photograph looked so different to me and why I liked it so much.
So what does doing this process, this difficult, finicky process, do for you artistically that film, say, wouldn't do for you?
I have my hands in every step of making a photograph, from mixing the chemistry in the beginning to, you know, exposing and developing. And that's not something that I could say, I think, in regards to film. So it's great because I have control over every little thing, but then oftentimes with this process, things go wrong and nothing shows up, or there's a bunch of fog and chemical, you know, artifacts all over the plate. And so it can be really challenging and really frustrating. But I'm learning all the time and I enjoy learning. So it's fun for me to make progress and to keep chipping away at this process.
Did you go to someone to train initially, or did you figure all of this out using YouTube?
YouTube has helped me since, but I took a two-day workshop in New York a few years ago and just kind of got the basics on how to take a tintype, but that did not include how to mix all the chemistry and how to troubleshoot when something went wrong. So really after that, I was on my own.
And so evidently you're not the only person doing this process. So there are, truly are, I was kind of joking about YouTube, but evidently there really are YouTubes about how to do this, how to mix the chemicals and how to do that kind of thing.
Yeah, sometimes it's funny to think that because of the internet, it's made it so much easier to make a photograph from this old time. And, you know, even ordering all my chemistry is extremely simple. If it wasn't for the internet, I probably wouldn't be able to do this at all. I wouldn't have found it, and I wouldn't be able to find who supplies the chemicals. And so, yeah, I have some tintype acquaintances online that I communicate with, and there are some YouTube videos that can help a little bit, but mostly I find that all my problems that I encounter with this process, I really have to just put in the work myself and test different things to figure out what's happening.
What is the public's reaction to this? Are people excited to get their pictures taken using this technology?
Yeah, I find that people that aren't even comfortable usually getting their photo taken really enjoy seeing what this process does. My uncle, for example, on the wall behind you, there's not a lot of photos of him, but when I brought all my chemistry up north for a family vacation, I wanted to photograph my aunts and uncles and my siblings and stuff in that setting. And he saw what I was doing, and I asked him if I could take his tintype. And at first he said no, but then when he saw the tintype of another relative of mine, he thought it was really cool, and then he did let me, and actually his photo is one of my favorites I've ever taken.
And this is this fellow right here with the beard?
Yes, that's my Uncle Tom.
One of the things, just looking around your studio and looking at the photos that you have up here, is that there's sort of an intimacy to it. Like this photograph of your uncle, it's actually kind of soft around the edges.
Right. That's an effect of the camera. But also in regards to the intimacy of this process, I think that this is very different because it takes a while to make one photo. And usually it's just me and a subject, and we spend at least an hour to make one photo. And that is really special these days when we're all used to taking a million pictures on our cell phone and deleting all of them but the one that we like the best. You know, I'm really taking a lot of time to make sure that the one photo we take is the one that we like best. So there is intimacy in that.
It's almost like before you even start, you're deleting options before you actually take the photograph, because you want to end up with just the one. You can't take more unless you set all up again.
Right. That's probably why I'm very serious when I'm working on a photo. I think my mood really changes when I get down to the time to take one. People have told me that before too. Maybe it's not.
You get very focused.
I think, right, I get really focused because I probably am deleting all the things that I know aren't going to work and making sure that I'm putting in place all the right things that do.
When you work with a subject, how much do you try to get to know them ahead of time, or do you try to let that just evolve as you're getting the photography set up, everything set up? Are you trying to find out, or do you want them to reveal themselves to you?
Ooh, that's a good question. Usually I don't know much about people when they come to sit down, but we get to talk a little bit, and I get to at least get a feel for their personality when they come in and I see their reaction to my space and the things I have on the wall. So I can usually tell right away what type of session it's going to be, but it's always really fun for me to get to that moment when we get to see the photo in the end, and usually after that is when everyone can take a deep breath, sigh of relief, and then we get to spend about 20 minutes together while the tintype washes and before I varnish it. It's nice to get to know people in that time.
You know, we're sitting in a hallway in the Pfister Hotel, and there are people, as we're doing this interview, looking in and wondering what's going on, not just with us, but, you know, with the entire thing. Do you overhear people wondering what's going on? And do you invite them in after?
Yes, I can hear everything that people say right outside of my door. Kind of is like a fish tank in here. There's big glass windows that look into the whole space. And usually people notice the big, giant camera that I have resting on a table in the window. And I hear a lot of discussion about that and what that is. I mean, a lot of people don't even realize it's a camera until I pop my head out a lot and say to come on in. And I talk a lot about my process, spend a lot of time telling people what a tintype is and showing them my dark room and the images on the wall. It's really fun.
Let's walk over to that, because I didn't realize it was a camera
either.
So let's, if you can tell me how it works, that's really cool.
It works exactly the same as my small 4x5. It's just on a much larger scale. So the whole thing is on a giant wooden track with some brass fixtures and knobs that move the front and back of it forward. And there's a giant lens sticking out on the front here. It's an old Kodak lens. And I'm not sure if this one came on the camera originally or not, but it is the right lens to cover as large of a space as 2 feet by 2 feet, which is as big of a tintype I'll be able to make once I get it working, which I'm very close to doing.
So are you just having to fix it, or is it just getting it settled in its space?
It needs no fixing. This camera is in really good shape. I just need to build a few things and modify a few things to be able to take a tintype with it. I need the accessories to go with the camera, but this camera is ready to go. I found this on Craigslist and drove to Louisville, Kentucky for it.
I was going to ask you where you found it. Yeah. Was it working there? Did they or was it just sitting somewhere in somebody's barn?
It was sitting in someone's living room, and they had just had a baby, so I think they wanted this thing out of there because it takes up quite a lot of space.
It sure does. I mean, the whole thing is, it looks like it's about 4 feet long, the whole frame underneath, and then it stands about, what, 2 feet high, 3 feet high?
Yeah, it's beautiful, and it's in really good shape. And then what we would see if we had turned this to some more light and a subject, we would see the image projected on the back, upside down and backwards is how it would appear on the ground glass there that I made. And so we would be able to focus the camera by moving this steering wheel of a knob, which is made out of brass, on the side there. And then once we got you in focus, you'd have to be pretty still while I prepare a huge tintype. This is all stuff that I'm thinking about. I haven't been able to do it yet, but I'm close. I'm really excited to see what type of photo I'll be able to take with a camera like this.
So what do you hope to get from this year's residency? Besides a place to work, which is a wonderful thing, and a public that goes by pretty regularly that you can, say, come in and see what's going on, what is this going to do for your practice?
It's done a lot already. Just being here and meeting so many people and getting to talk about this process, it, I think, has really solidified for me the fact that this is what I'm going to be doing for a very long time. And I don't know if that's something I knew for sure before I came in here, but getting everyone's reactions and everyone's support especially has really made that very clear to me. And so I'm really excited to use every moment of this year to plug away at getting better at this process and making work that impresses me.
Well, Margaret, I want to thank you so much for taking some time out, for showing me around here, and best of luck. Maybe in a couple of months we'll come back and see how this big boy is doing here.
Please do. Hold me to that.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Tintype photographer Margaret Musa is the Pfister Hotel's current artist in residence. She'll be in residence there through next spring, and you can see some of her work and see the studio space at WUWN.com. That's all for the Thursday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It is 11 o'clock, and fresh air comes your way next.